The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome, everyone. It's nice to see you all this morning. The topic I thought to explore this morning is the topic of wisdom. We talk about wisdom a lot here, and one of my teachers, Saito Utejaniya, has said that the whole purpose of our practice is to cultivate wisdom. That's why we're practicing, is to cultivate wisdom. But there's not just any kind of wisdom we want to cultivate. There's a particular, I mean, it's the wisdom about many things that we can learn. We can learn wisdom about how to drive a car, or you know, we could even think about wisdom in terms of any activity that we do and become skilled at. And so meditation, similarly, as a skill, there's a kind of a set of, maybe we could say, guidelines or understandings that support a skillful development of that particular activity of mind. And so what is that? What is that wisdom? The Buddha sometimes said, "Everything I teach, what I teach, is suffering and the end of suffering." This was his awakening, this was his understanding, this was his recognition about how the mind can be at peace through the transcending of suffering, through the release of suffering. And so the wisdom that the Buddha offers is connected to this question of suffering. This question of why do we suffer? How do we suffer? What is that about? And one of the key pieces that was pointed to, that the Buddha pointed to, is that there's stuff that goes on in the world. You know, there's awful things that happen in the world and wonderful things that happen in the world. And our way of relating to those things that happen in the world, very different for each of us. And many of us do have reactivity around certain things in the world. And so the freedom that the Buddha was pointing to, where he said it's possible to be free of suffering, free of this quality dukkha, which the definition, the Pali word dukkha, the word has a broad range. It's not that the word suffering that we use in English to translate that word dukkha is a pretty, it's not such a good translation in some ways, because our connection with the term suffering is a pretty, often a pretty major event in our lives when we say, "I'm suffering." We might not say, if we're a little bit frustrated, we might not say, "I'm suffering." Or if we're a little bit irritated, we might not say, "I'm suffering." But the suffering that's represented by this word dukkha is a very broad range, from the subtlest kind of unease or dissatisfaction or distress through the greatest reactivity, the greatest like anger, hatred, rage. So the range is broad. And, you know, the Buddha pointed to, what the Buddha pointed to is that the freedom that's possible, the freedom from suffering that's possible, is not freedom from events in the world that happen, not freedom from the fact that people in the world do both awful things and beautiful things, that our practice is not going to transform the things other people do necessarily, although it is definitely true, much as we see how, you know, anger is like contagious. And so when somebody is angry at us, we often respond with anger, because it's like the way that our systems are put together in some ways, although it's not necessary to respond in that way. But also, as we cultivate wisdom and compassion and kindness, those qualities are also contagious. And so there's a way that as we do engage in this kind of letting our minds release from suffering, letting our minds release from reactivity, that it does affect the world. But it also, the Buddha said, it is not that unpleasant things happen in the world and pleasant things happen in the world. That is the way things are. Becoming at ease, at peace, does not mean that we experience entirely pleasant experience. And so what he pointed to is that the freedom that's possible is not freedom, not somehow creating some world where everything is exactly the way I want it to be, but being in relationship with the world in a different way. Being in relationship to what happens in the world without reactivity. And the key three pieces are of reactivity, the functions of our mind that are experienced as reactivity are greed, aversion, and delusion. We could say that the whole of our reactive set of emotions is some mixture of these three, greed, aversion, and delusion. And so the Buddha pointed to the freedom that's possible, the ease that's possible from this dukkha, is freedom from these three reactive qualities of mind. And so the wisdom that is cultivated, is developed, is around understanding that peace and ease are not dependent on the conditions of the world, but are related to how we are in relationship to the conditions of the world. If we are in relationship to the conditions of the world with some mixture of greed, aversion, and delusion, we will be suffering. If we are in relationship to the world with compassion, kindness, wisdom, patience, calm, peace, ease, if that is the relationship to the world, our hearts will be at peace. Now, this heart at peace is not, it's not necessarily a non-responsive. I mean, I would say that really the qualities that create this ease and peace of heart, I mean, even the words ease and peace to us often have this connotation of chill, you know, not doing anything. It's like, yeah, I'm at peace. I don't have to do anything. But the way that these qualities manifest in the heart is very connected to emotions of acting in the world to alleviate suffering. Compassion and wisdom want to act in the world. So they're not passive qualities that are being cultivated. So the wisdom that the Buddha is pointing to that creates this transformation of release from suffering, creates this movement from a relationship to the world out of greed, aversion, delusion, to the relationship to the world out of generosity, love, compassion, wisdom. This movement both alleviates these reactive qualities, which tend to be what we are acting in the world out of often. And one of the bits of wisdom that's useful to recognize is that, you know, those reactive qualities of mind motivate action also. And so it tends to be that when we're, and they tend to reinforce those when we act out of those qualities of greed, aversion, and delusion, that reinforces those qualities so that those become more likely to be the reasons that we react in the future. And so the Buddha points to those actual, and those qualities of mind when they're active, when those qualities of mind are active, then it's like their belief, the view or the belief that's kind of embedded in those qualities of mind, in those reactive qualities of mind. The view, for instance, of anger or aversion is the only way to be happy or at ease is to separate myself from the thing that I don't like. That's the view that's embedded in aversion. the view that's embedded in greed is the only way to be happy is to stay connected with the thing that I like. And so these views have this inherent kind of belief that if you don't act on me, if you don't act out of this anger to get separated from this thing you don't like, you are going to be unhappy. It's going to be painful. You're not going to have peace in your life. And so these unwholesome qualities of mind carry this view, which is a delusion. It is a delusion that the only way to be happy is to follow through on those qualities of mind. Those qualities of mind are not going to tell you that there's another way. They're not going to tell you that there's another option, which might be to... And this is, again, some of the wisdom the Buddha taught, that it is possible to hold the experience of the unpleasant with... It's possible to have the relationship of experience to unpleasant, to not being that of aversion, but being that of compassion. When there is something painful arising, the heart, the open heart, the heart that is not constricted, not kind of wrapped up in this quality of aversion, has a sense of compassion, either for ourselves or for others experiencing this unpleasant quality. And that compassion can hold the unpleasantness. Sometimes that compassion will take an action to change the conditions. And sometimes that compassion recognizes, yeah, this is a situation that there's not control over. And so an appropriate response is to kind of hold the distress and kind of ride it out. So there are times when that kind of riding it out is appropriate and times when action is appropriate. But the action from compassion doesn't come from hatred or aversion. It comes from love. And that's it's a very different response in the mind. And so this wisdom of the Buddha, you know, we could the Buddha kind of articulated this wisdom in one teaching, the Four Noble Truths. And we can just summarize that. He said that we should understand suffering. And this understanding of suffering is precisely what I've been pointing to, that we begin to understand that this quality of offness that we feel is not inherent in what's happening in the world, but is some place of our connection or relationship to what is happening. And that it is that relationship to suffering that creates suffering or that has the suffering happening is a relationship of craving, of basically feeling like this situation, I can't be happy with this situation happening. Either I need to hold on to something and keep it, or I need to get rid of something. And so the craving is kind of the engine that in our mind that keeps us out of balance, keeps us off kilter. And so the second noble truth, so the first noble truth, understand suffering, partly means to begin to recognize that suffering is that the quality of suffering that can be released is the suffering that is created in relationship to experience, that's connected to these three qualities that underlie our reactivity of greed, aversion, and delusion. And the second noble truth says that we could summarize that as kind of craving, those three together as craving. And he says that releasing or letting go of craving is the action around suffering. So letting go of this cause of our reactive mind, letting go of this, why this reactivity arises. And that he said it is possible to realize a freedom and a peace and an ease when we have that release from greed, aversion, and delusion, we will experience a peace And it's such a different kind of peace than we anticipate or that we think it might be. Again, because the habitual way that we've been engaging in our lives has been kind of wrapped up in the views around greed, aversion, and delusion. You know, the views of I have to have this in order to be happy, I have to get rid of this in order to be happy. These are the delusions embedded in greed and aversion. And so the whole way that we've been living our lives has been motivated by these misunderstandings about a true happiness, a deeper kind of happiness. Now, there is a kind of happiness that comes when we separate ourselves from something unpleasant or get to stay with something that's pleasant. But the Buddha points to that kind of happiness. And we see this, actually. We know it somewhere inside, that kind of happiness that comes from separating ourselves from something unpleasant or that comes from being in connection with something pleasant, that kind of happiness doesn't last for very long. It's not very stable. And so his inquiry about this, is it possible to be free from suffering, was not, can I create conditions where I can string, you know, moment after moment of getting what I want and getting rid of what I don't want. But he wanted to see, is there something more reliable than that? And he found in his experience, in his depth of his understanding, that the release from greed, aversion, and delusion is a deeper kind of happiness. And in that release, we are very naturally motivated by wisdom and compassion and love, patience. And so the experience of release, this is the third noble truth that is possible, and that is the activity connected with the third noble truth, that we realize this release, this freedom from greed, aversion, delusion. And then he went on to point out to the fourth noble truth that there's a possibility for cultivating this freedom, this wisdom, possibility for cultivating this release. And he named the Eightfold Path: wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, as being kind of the path that helps us to understand the suffering, that supports us to let go of the reactivity, that lets us realize the release. And so the whole thing comes to this cultivation of the path, and we can say that this path actually, that what this path is doing in the very first aspect of the path, wise view or wise understanding, is kind of this framing or this orientation of what is the wisdom? What do we need to understand in order to move in this direction of letting go of these reactive emotions? Not so that we can be some like chill like meditator in a cave, but so that we can be engaged in the world in a skillful way. The Buddha was engaged in the world. He spent time on retreat, but he also spent time walking around India, spent time on the battlefield trying to stop a war. He spent time talking to kings about how they could skillfully guide their kingdoms. So he was engaged in the world, and he retreated from the world. So the path is essentially tools for helping us cultivate wisdom. So this is the piece I really kind of want to explore, not through the Eightfold Path, although that's a great way to explore the cultivation and development of wisdom, but I like to come at it from a different direction. There's one place in the teachings where the Buddha talked about three levels of wisdom. There's the wisdom, and this is where we all have to begin, pretty much with anything that we're learning. You know, that we have to hear something, like what I offered this morning, this exploration around where is it, why is it that we struggle? I mean, I think before I met the practice, I certainly assumed the problem was in the world, mostly, and that I was just doing my best to like navigate that. And then I heard some of these teachings and began looking at my own mind and began to see how much I was contributing to my own suffering. This seeing is a cultivation of wisdom. We begin to change our focus in terms of where, you know, where we aim our work in effect. So the this first kind of wisdom is basically hearing some of the wisdom of the Buddha, hearing some teachings, hearing. So for this case, I mean, you know, we might in other scenarios, if we want to learn about astrophysics, you know, we need to read books on astrophysics to learn the knowledge that's been collected in our species about this topic, and then maybe we can grow in that area. And so what we're doing here with the first aspect of wisdom is collecting, gathering the information that's been collected by our species, by the Buddha, by the people who followed the Buddha, how to engage. And so this is the first kind of wisdom. It's called Suttamayapanya, the wisdom of hearing. And so this would include reading books and listening to talks and talking to friends about their understanding. So this is the first place we get the understanding, the wisdom of the Buddha. And it's said that there are a few people in the world who would kind of come into this understanding of where suffering comes from in their own minds. But it said that kind of person is really rare, and that most of us need to hear it. Most of us need to have somebody point it out to us. And so this is where it begins, is hearing something about how suffering comes to be. And so the second level of wisdom is where we kind of begin to connect or evaluate or reflect on what we've heard. We listen and we maybe think about, does this make sense to me? So there's instructions that are included. One of the pieces around the wisdom of the Buddha is it's not simply, what I offered this morning was more a description of how suffering comes to be and the kind of place or the understanding about how suffering we can be free from suffering. But these teachings, the wisdom that the Buddha offers is not simply that statement of here's how suffering comes to be. It also includes practices. It includes activities of meditation, of investigation, of reflection that are taught to help us to look at it in our own minds. And so this is the second level of wisdom, where essentially we're evaluating, looking at what we've learned, and using those teachings perhaps to begin to investigate our own experience. This is the second level of wisdom is called Cittamayapanya, which translates as the wisdom connected with reflecting and thinking about. I think also it's connected with applying the teachings. It's not just thinking about it, it's actively, okay, well, they say that being aware of, you know, so one way to frame a piece of the wisdom is being aware of anger, for instance, instead of acting on it. Being aware of anger with mindfulness and watching it, essentially asking the question something like, what is it like to be a human being that's angry? As opposed to, I'm really angry, I need to do something about this. It's like, well, let's just see what it's like to be a human being that's angry. That exploration has a transformative effect. It's kind of like we disengage the gears of that anger. You know, the anger, when we're following through on it, it's like we've got our foot on the gas pedal and we're just winding that anger up. But we see actually pretty quickly if we explore being, well, let's see what it's like to be angry. What is it like, that feeling? What is it like to be a human being that's angry? It's like disengaging the gears. We experience that quality of mind and it creates different conditions. It allows for a release. And so this kind of practice of mindfulness, of being aware of experience, is a piece of the wisdom that the Buddha offers. So it's not just about like the word teachings. It's also about engaging with the practices. And so that's where this second level of wisdom comes in. First of all, we might need to reflect, does this make sense to me? When actually, when I first heard this very teaching around anger, you know, try noticing that you're angry and being aware of the experience rather than following through on the anger or trying to repress it, which was my other strategy. You know, I'm not going to be angry. I'm going to stuff that. That also creates, you know, kind of in a way, it's engaged the gears. That anger kind of goes underground and it's not processed or metabolized. And so when I first heard that teaching, try just being with your anger, knowing it's there, understanding it. I was like, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't get how that's going to do any good. In fact, I would imagine that would actually make me feel more angry. But I had a friend who'd said, hey, this has helped me. You could try this. And so there was the book, the hearing, the reading, the Sutta Mayapanya from getting this little tiny bit of wisdom from the book. And then there was the friend that said, you know, this works. And so it's like, okay, I took those two hearings and put them together and said, don't get how this is going to work, but I'm willing to try. I'm willing to see what happens if I do this. So that was some of the Chintamayapanya, you know, the reflecting on, am I willing to do this? And then the beginning to engage. The third level of wisdom is where we actually begin to understand for ourselves the truth of these teachings, where we experience, it's essentially that there's been enough engagement with the practices that wisdom is strengthening. And this is the place where wisdom becomes a quality of mind. So in the first two levels of wisdom, it's more like the wisdom is almost external. It's something that we're learning or hearing about and something that we're thinking about. We may begin to practice with it, but it doesn't so much feel like there's an understanding of the deeper truths of that wisdom. It's more like we're taking it on faith. Like I took it on faith, my friend saying, yeah, this has helped me. It's like, okay, got no idea how this is going to work, but I'm going to try. So that those first two levels of wisdom are about, you know, kind of taking in the information and seeing, is there some sense of willingness to engage? And with that willingness, you know, these teachings are really, really powerful. If we engage with these teachings, as I found in my own exploration of this, my very first practice, looking at anger in my life, it didn't take long before I had an inkling of why it was actually useful, of how it worked. Maybe not how it worked, but that it worked. Because, you know, I began in the first even couple of weeks of doing this, I began to see that it did not make me more angry. It actually created the conditions for me to be able to let go of it without having to repress it. It was kind of like the very first time I noticed it. It was like, wow, anger sure doesn't feel very good. This hurts. That was what I noticed. I was in pretty deep anger by that point, quite a rage, because it was a little while before the mindfulness and awareness of, oh, I told myself I was going to pay attention to this, that kicked in. And so the first experience of being with that anger was, wow, this is painful. And I have no idea what to do with this. Well, I guess I go back to work. As I was sitting at my computer doing work. And in retrospect, as I thought back on it, that was really remarkable. Because prior to that moment, and in previous times that I'd gotten angry, I had stayed frozen at my computer for long stretches of time. In a rage. And then felt like I had to repress the anger when I came back. Like, oh, I've got to get to work. And in this case, it was more like, wow, that hurts. I don't know what to do with this. Well, I guess I'll go back to work. And it wasn't about repressing. it was like, wow, that's pretty amazing that it gave me a whole new relationship to that experience. So pretty quickly, that moment, actually, when I think about it, that moment, that was where wisdom was an alive quality in the mind. Wisdom was already alive there, recognizing the suffering of that anger and recognizing the possibility of setting it aside in a different way. It was like, I didn't know how to do that. Wisdom helped me to do that. So this is the third level of wisdom, where wisdom becomes more of a quality of in our minds, a functioning in our minds, an activity in our minds. And the deeper that the wisdom becomes, the more it guides our choices. You know, this is the way all qualities of mind, there's a term that the Buddha used called mental formations or volitional formations. And these are the qualities of mind that tend to be those that we act out of. You know, they inform our intentions to action. And, you know, anger, greed are qualities of mind that inform our intentions of action. So they're some of these volitional formations. There's a whole bunch of reactive volitional formations that we tend to be motivated by. They tend to guide and shape our actions. And this quality of wisdom is one of those qualities. It is a quality that guides and shapes our actions. It is not me doing that. It is, and that was so clear as this quality of wisdom grew and I began to watch how the mind made different choices. It's like, wow, I never would have known that choice was possible. It was pretty clear I didn't make that choice, that it was coming from something deeper, a deeper kind of wisdom. And so this is where wisdom really begins to act in our lives. So there's ways that this is cultivated. You know, the wisdom does get cultivated in the hearing aspect as we're hearing teachings. There is a way that there's a beginning cultivation of wisdom, and then as we begin to engage with the reflective aspect, we can sometimes use those teachings to help us as we're practicing. So this is a way in which we can actively cultivate wisdom by, you know, almost remembering or reflecting on teachings or learnings or understandings. And some of these teachings we might be what we would call borrowed, either from what our teachers have said or from what we've learned. So there are times when, like at that very first one, was like, I do not see how this is going to work. My friend said it worked, so I'll give it a try. I was borrowing her wisdom there. I was borrowing that and choosing to engage, even though I didn't understand how it would work. And then there are times in our practice where, you know, I'm sure many of you have experienced this, where we, you know, begin to see something, and there's like moments where it's like so clear. Yeah, following through on that aversion is not the way. And the mind just begins to let it go, and we see a whole different way of being. We feel a space around the anger. We see wisdom at work. We see how it's manifesting. You know, sometimes this quality of feeling a space around a difficulty where it feels like there's a different choice that's possible, that is wisdom at work. That's an expression of it. And so sometimes we've seen that. And then, you know, we think, the way we habitually have related to the cultivation of wisdom, is we think that once we've seen that, that we should forevermore have that. But what happens in our practice is that the powers of delusion, the kind of habits, the conditioned understandings around, yeah, I need to separate myself from the unpleasant, hold myself to the pleasant, those powers are so deeply conditioned that they come back. And I remember sometimes, even within the space of an hour on a retreat or in a sitting, seeing something really clearly, and it's like, oh, wow, and the little belief in the mind, I'm never going to suffer over that again, you know? And then like 15 minutes later, it's like, what? Wait a minute. I thought I'd understood that. And so I began to understand that the insights, where wisdom is really strong and we're really seeing clearly the insights, those are impermanent. And the delusion is strong. And, you know, it's like, yes, the conditions are here right now for me to see this clearly, for the wisdom to be strong. The conditions are here right now for the wisdom to be strong and to help the mind see through this. And so not to hold on to that, because often the delusion comes back. And there is a kind of a spiral nature of the development of wisdom. And so sometimes we, you know, when that delusion comes back, you know, we can borrow, we can remember. If we're not beating ourselves up for not remembering or feeling like we should be able to remember or recall that understanding on the split second, if we're not beating ourselves up about that, we can borrow our own wisdom. It's like, yes, I know that this is the mind seeing things in a confused way. This is delusion in the mind right now. And maybe this is not the time to make a big decision. So that we can borrow our own wisdom and our own understanding. It's like, yeah, I know this is the mind of confusion. There's a different way. Sometimes I'm not even able to remember what the different way is, but I just know, yeah, I know this is messed up. And then sometimes as I hang out with it, it's like, oh yeah, that's the wisdom here that this mind needs to recognize. Yeah, this is the mind believing separation is going to be happiness. And that, can I hang out with this? Can I just be with this? And so there's a way of borrowing our own understanding. And sometimes the language that our mind creates when it has an understanding. You know, there was one understanding my mind had, particularly around a quality of self-hatred. And I'd done a lot of work, you know, looking at the self-hatred, bringing my mindfulness to it, remembering the teachings about it. And then there was one moment where there was a really clear seeing into the self-hatred. And the understanding was expressed in my mind. So there was the recognition of the mind having done this self-hatred, that it was a construction in the moment. And there was a release of freedom from that in the moment. And the way it kind of bubbled up into language in my mind was, this is just a thought. So that was the way the wisdom expressed. The thought itself was not the factor of wisdom. It was more like the factor of wisdom kind of massaged into my mind and produced this reflection. And so that thought, oh, this is just a thought. This self-hatred, it's just a thought in the mind. It doesn't have any inherent reality. That understanding kind of became my go-to phrase when self-hatred came back. And very powerful, the reflection back to my own understanding. Like, so when self-hatred came back, it could be more like, oh yeah, I do know this is just a thought. I'm not feeling that right now, but I'm borrowing, you know, it's kind of like borrowing my own wisdom. And that created the conditions for there to be a little bit more ease around this particular time the self-hatred is arising. Created the capacity for the mind to be able to be with it, to hold it in this more balanced way, rather than believing it and feeling like it was who I was. I could recognize it's a construction. It's happening right now. It's impermanent. It will pass. It is the mind doing this. So the practice was kind of a spiraling around the wisdom that we've learned, combined with our own engagement and what we actually learn in that engagement, the wisdom that grows in us, and then revisiting it as our minds go back into their habitual ways of responding to the world, revisiting that wisdom, reminding ourselves of that wisdom. And in this way, the wisdom gets deeper and deeper and deeper until the point where it is said, the possibility that the Buddha pointed to in the second and the third noble truth, is that it is possible to be completely free from these reactive qualities of mind, from greed, aversion, and delusion. There is a point in this path where they will not arise again. And that is wisdom at work. It's the wisdom gets strong enough that it is there. And in the wisdom being there, it no longer is submerged by the old habits of delusion. The wisdom has grown strong enough to have those habits of delusion not arise again. And so there's a long period in our practice where there is this like understanding something and forgetting it. Understanding it and, well, maybe not forgetting it. It's actually not forgetting it so much as it is, you know, the understanding is there when we've had that kind of understanding like I had around my self-hatred. Oh, this is just a thought. That is not, it's not that that goes away. But what happens is that it gets kind of submerged or it gets kind of overwhelmed by our old habits of delusion. But because it's there, there's more capacity for us to recognize, oh, this is delusion. This is the mind being really confused about what's going on. This layer of belief. The mind begins to understand that because it has seen something else. And so it gets easier to see through that delusion. It gets easier to remember those wisdoms, remember that understanding. And that helps us to recognize, oh yeah, this is the mind doing that thing again. Okay. So it's not that it goes away. It's more that it gets kind of submerged a little bit. And so over the course of our practice, it's like the wisdom gets more and more, it gets deeper and deeper. It's like it grows in depth, and so it begins to bubble up above our subconscious awareness more and more until it's always available. So we develop wisdom in this practice in many different ways. And part of the way we develop wisdom is by recognizing these little understandings, these little insights, you know, the feeling of what it's like when we know, oh yeah, this is just something happening. This is anger at work, that kind of just the mind that recognizes the human experience of something. When we have that understanding, we can feel the space around experience. And we can recognize, oh, that's wisdom at work. There's many different expressions of wisdom at work. This is just one. And I have a whole talk that I sometimes do that just kind of goes through many different ways that we can experience wisdom at work. But the recognition of it will cultivate the quality. Just as if we continue to engage in recognizing and or continue to kind of buy into anger, cultivates more anger. The more we, so the same process, it's kind of like if we frequently engage in reactivity, that's what will grow in the mind. If we frequently engage in wisdom, recognizing it and interested in how it affects us, that will grow in the mind. And so that kind of, the kind of recognition at one point, Sayadaw Utejaniya said, notice that wisdom, when wisdom is working in the mind and how that expresses. And when he first gave me that instruction, it's like, I have no idea what he means. But I went, and this kind of talk around, you know, different ways of seeing wisdom came out of that exploration. When I first started the inquiry, all I could say was, when I felt a little bit of ease or peace, it's like, well, wisdom must be working there. Okay. I don't know what kind of wisdom's at work there, but, you know, okay, that's wisdom at work. So that's where it began. And then I began to understand a little more clearly the nature of the understanding, the nature of, maybe sometimes it was about understanding how something was conditioned. Sometimes it was understanding something about the impermanence of something. Sometimes it was about understanding, this is just not a very reliable place to land. And so the mind began to really understand the wisdom at work. And that seeing of it or connecting to that is one of the things that supports the cultivation of wisdom. As the Buddha said, whatever we frequently ponder, that becomes the inclination of the mind. If we frequently ponder wisdom at any of these levels, our minds begin to head in that direction. So it's time to stop. Thank you for your attention.